Tax Update for Saturday, June 23, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update for this Saturday, June the 23rd. This week, we take a look at another S-Corporation loan issue that came down from the tax court recently as we look at the issue of S-Corporation debt once again. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the documents related to the podcast may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such a prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. You can visit them on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Well, this week I'm on my way to Syracuse to do a couple of presentations for the New York Society of CPAs, and one of the two presentations is going to deal with pass-through entities. And so it's appropriate that recently the tax court came down with yet another case on debt basis and S-corporations, an issue that we considered a couple of weeks ago in the Ruck-Rigel case back in April that dealt with a failed attempt of a taxpayer to treat certain debts as basis in their S-corporation. This week, we look at the case of Miller versus Commissioner, TC Memo 2006-125, where the tax court decided the matter in the taxpayer's favor despite the IRS's objections, and also dealt with an area for whether the taxpayer was truly at risk for the debt in question under Section 465. Now, let's go back and review the basic rules for S-corporation debt and using that debt as basis for purposes of claiming losses that pass through from the S-corporation for a shareholder. We visited this a few weeks ago in the Ruck-Rigel case, where we noted that the key issue is under Section 1366(d)(1). That section provides that, essentially, the aggregate amount of losses and deductions taken into account by a shareholder under subsection A for any taxable year shall not exceed the sum of, and we go to first the adjusted basis in the stock, but then second under 1366(d)(1)(b), we talk about the shareholder's adjusted basis of any indebtedness of the S-corporation to the shareholder. Now, it's been a significant tripping point because that particular language requires the debt to be to the shareholder directly. Indirect debt or debt that's not truly from the S-corporation to the shareholder will not count, even if the shareholder might be liable under that debt or at least potentially liable under the debt. Guarantees don't count. And as the Ruck-Rigel case told us, indirect debt, where we have an entity that we control loan money to the S-corporation, will also fail this test. In the Ruck-Rigel case, remember, we had a controlled partnership that loaned funds to the S-corporation that would be owned by the partners of the partnership. It didn't matter that maybe the ownership was the same and that the partnership loaned to the S-corporation. The problem was the individual shareholders in their capacity of shareholders needed to make the loan. What this really means is that in this particular area of the tax law, the form of a transaction is incredibly important. That although we often talk about substance over form, that generally doesn't work in this area. Now let's take a look at the facts in the Miller case. Mr. Miller was the majority shareholder in Miller Medical Systems, and throughout the case it's referred to as MMS. This entity manufactured mobile and modular medical diagnostic facilities, and Mr. Miller had four outside investors who contributed capital to MMS on the condition that the corporation obtain a $1 million line of credit from its bank, which it did. Now, it's important to note this initial debt went from the bank to the corporation, not from the bank to Mr. Miller. So we had a disqualified debt to start. Now, Mr. Miller guaranteed the debt in full, and as any of you who work with closely held corporations are aware, it's incredibly normal. Banks don't normally loan to a closely held corporation without getting some guarantees from the shareholders. In essence, they're not going to allow you to to use the corporate protection to insulate the shareholders from all debt responsibilities. If we're loaning, we want access to the funds of the shareholder. And Mr. Miller's co-investors each guaranteed a limited amount of the debt. In essence, they each were liable for a proportionate share of the debt. They didn't guarantee individually the entire debt, but as a group, they had essentially guaranteed the debt. MMS operated in the red, basically had losses, and through 1991, Mr. Miller had losses from the S Corporation that were being held in suspense for lack of basis of $600,000. As the end of 1992, the next year in play, approached, it became clear MMS would again generate a loss. So Mr. Miller actually sought advice from his tax advisor on how to proceed. This is a client who actually looked ahead and asked before the end of the year. Important thing for your clients to be doing, an important thing to remind your clients they should be doing. Mr. Miller was advised by his tax advisor at Ernst & Young that the loan needed to be restructured if he was going to be able to claim these losses. The advisor then wrote a letter to the bank explaining the situation and proposing a solution where the debt would be reissued to Mr. Miller, who would then loan the funds to the corporation. The letter noted that this transaction had to take place before December 31, 1992. The court then went on in its opinion and gave us the following actions that the bank took in response to this letter. In response, Huntington, which was the bank in this question, agreed to reissue the line of credit to petitioner personally with guarantees with essentially the same terms and conditions, including the Rapp Group guarantee. The Rapp Group was the four investors who went in with them, three of whom were named Rapp. So basically it became the Rapp Group was a reference we make to this group when we talk about them in the case. As the MMS Huntington loan with certain additional conditions. There were some other additions added, and they were that all funds drawn by the petitioner, which would be Mr. Miller, on the personal line of credit were required to be deposited in a restricted account in his name at the bank, and all withdrawals from the restricted account were required to go into an account at the bank maintained by MMS, the corporation. So Mr. Miller, when he drew on this personal line of credit, had to pull it into a restricted account. The only place funds could go out of that account was to MMS, the corporation. The petitioner would be required, Mr. Miller would be required to warrant that all draws on the personal credit line would be used exclusively for MMS's construction costs for diagnostic units under contract. Second, the petition held that rather than Mr. Miller making cash contributions to MMS, Mr. Miller would extend a $1 million line of credit to MMS, which would be funded by his line of credit, for which MMS would execute a promissory note and security agreement in favor of Mr. Miller. MMS would provide a security line of credit to Mr. Miller, the same collateral that has secured the original line of credit with Huntington. Finally, although that the advisor had proposed that MMS serve as guarantor with respect to the line of credit extended by the bank to Mr. Miller, in this case, the bank said, we want Mr. Miller to make a collateral assignment to the bank of all of his rights under the security agreement given to Mr. Miller by MMS for the line of credit running between them, as well as collateral assignment of the promissory note itself executed by MMS in favor of Mr. Miller. So Mr. Miller would execute this collateral assignment where he agreed to assign his rights in the event of a default to the bank. Now, the court noted, again, that the bank put the restrictions on the loan to ensure these funds were only used by the corporation. So the only place these funds could go went to the corporation. Goes on to note, both the Miller-Huntington and the MMS Miller loans were due on December 31, 1993, and carried the same interest rate as the old loan from the corporation to the corporation and the bank's loan, 0.5 point above the bank's prime rate. Interest payable monthly and advance payments of principal were permitted. The Miller-Huntington, which was the new loan, and the MMS Miller loans contained the same limitation on advances as in the old loan from the bank to the corporation. Advances could only be made from the bank to Mr. Miller and then from Mr. Miller to MMS. And we had restrictions on the amounts of $250 to cover construction costs for facilities under contract. And basically, again, the reiterated that we had to put the money into a restricted account, and that those restricted accounts, basically, when MMS made a payment with respect to its obligation under the loan to Mr. Miller, such repayment was required to be deposited back into that restricted account and held in trust for the bank. As security for the loan, the MMS Miller loan, MMS granted Mr. Miller a security interest in the same collateral that the old loan with the bank had had, all of its assets, including equipment, inventory, accounts receivable. Then in the security agreement for the loan from the taxpayer, the individual, Mr. Miller, to the bank, he made a collateral assignment to the bank of all of his rights under that note, including the promissory note executed in his favor. So basically, he did the collateral assignment that transferred all of his rights, and he held all the rights the banks previously had held. He agreed to certain covenants with respect to the loan from him, from the bank to himself, including that other than the extension of credit to MMS under this loan line of credit, that Mr. Miller would not and would cause MMS not to lend or incur indebtedness except indebtedness for the purchase of property equal to the purchase price. He also was required under the Miller-Huntington loan to submit MMS's financial statements, not his, but MMS's, and a report of MMS's accounts receivable to the bank on a monthly basis, and to submit personal financial statements as the bank from time to time might require. No covenants had been required of the petitioner as guaranteed of the MMS-Huntington loan. The Miller-Huntington loan further provided that an event of default would exist if either the petitioner or MMS became insolvent, or if MMS failed to comply with any provision of the MMS Miller loan. So at the end of the day, you can kind of say that from a form standpoint, you know, maybe we had all these forms different. From a substance standpoint, nothing really had changed. It looked awfully, an awful lot like the old position where MMS was under the same restrictions, and if they violated those restrictions, the bank credit came due. And while we had the bank call Mr. Miller's loan and be able then to force Mr. Miller to call the loan from MMS, arguably we got the same result as we did in the old days when the bank would have just called the loan directly from MMS. And, of course, that's what the IRS is going to be arguing here, that in essence that we were able to look through all of this and just say at the end of the day, nothing happened. Well, we'll get back to whether or not that's true, whether or not that was sufficient to blow this loan for basis purposes, because we go on to the facts. MMS continued to lose money and eventually became insolvent, triggering a default under the loan. At that point, the following situation unfolded. In December of 1994, the corporation became insolvent. At that time, there was an outstanding balance of $1,375,000 on the Miller-Huntington loan. On December 29th of that year, the Rapp Group paid $900,000 to Huntington in partial satisfaction of the Miller-Huntington loan. That outside investor group then satisfied the remaining $475,000 on the Miller-Huntington loan by taking out personal loans from the bank and using the proceeds to purchase the Miller-Huntington note. Concurrently, Mr. Miller and the Rapp Group formed a new entity operating under the name MSR Technologies LLC, which purchased MMS's remaining assets and completed MMS's outstanding contracts. Upon the new entity's completion of the contract, the new entity paid the proceeds to the Rapp Group, which in turn used the proceeds to repay their personal loans from Huntington. Now, as of the date the case was tried, Mr. Miller had not made any payment to the Rapp Group to reimburse them for their payments to satisfy the Miller-Huntington loan pursuant to the guarantees, nor had the investor group sought reimbursement from Mr. Miller. Now, there's the end of the day. So at the end of the day, Mr. Miller actually never paid on this loan. The loan was defaulted. The actual loan got paid by his investors. And so now we're going to go down round the road of what was the actual result, what should have been the result for his tax return. It certainly smells bad at that point, it seems like, since Mr. Miller never seemed to pay anything out of pocket. Now, Mr. Miller ended up reporting the following items on his tax return, which became the issue of the dispute with the IRS. Now, he reflected the outstanding loan balances on the loan at the end of 92, 93, and 94. It would be of $750,000, $1,184,930, and $1,375,000, respectively, as being outstanding at those dates. And he claimed a basis in indebtedness from MMS of $750,000 in 92, as well as increases of 434,930 as of December 31st, 93, and 190,000 as of December 31st, 1994. So he claimed those amounts. He subsequently deducted ordinary losses from MMS in the amount of $750,000 for 92, $431,691 for 1993, and $189,845 for 94. And those losses produced net operating loss deductions for the years in question, as well as carryover deductions of $238,293 for 94 and $206,178 for 95. He also claimed a short-term capital loss of a whole whopping $58,49, a long-term loss carryover $81,94 for 1994, both of which were carried over into 95. Now, Mr. Miller did not report any interest income from the MMS Miller loan, the loan from the corporation to him, on their 93 return. On the 94 return, though, he did report $109,674 of taxable interest income attributable to MMS. Now, remember, the initial loan transaction took place at the very end of 92. There would have been a full year of 1993 interest that would have been paid. Then in 1994, another full year of interest. This appears to be another bad fact that could hurt Mr. Miller's claim that he really was the one who loaned the money to the corporation. However, as noted, in the following year he picked it up. Was this a footfault that's a minor detail, or is this going to be significant? Obviously, from the IRS's perspective, this was a significant issue. We'll have to see from Mr. Miller's perspective. He said it's just an error. Now we go to what the court felt. Well, the IRS had a number of claims here. First, they claimed that the debt was not truly the debt from Mr. Miller to the corporation. Therefore, he had no basis against which to claim the losses. Now, the tax court, citing Gilday versus Commissioner, which was a tax court memo from 1982, noted that the substitution of a note was accepted as a method to come into compliance with 1366 D1B as long as the transaction had economic substance to it. Applying Gilday to the fact pattern, he said, the court noted, viewing the restructuring of this line of credit as a whole, we believe under the principles of Gilday versus Commissioner and Rayner versus Commissioner, petitioners are entitled to the basis they have claimed. The December 30, 1992 transaction conformed in all material respects to the note substitution in Gilday. Petitioner gave his fully recourse $1 million promissory note to Huntington to replace MMS's promissory note of like amount on which he had formerly served as guarantor. Huntington thereupon advanced $750,000 under petitioner's note and recorded MMS's note as satisfied by virtue of the payment of its $750,000 outstanding balance. MMS, in turn, gave a promissory note to petitioner, which mirrored the items of petitioner's note to Huntington. Participating in the foregoing transaction as an independent third-party lender, which was a factor critical to the result in Gilday. But as noted, as in Gilday, the principal purpose for the note substitution was to generate basis for purposes of 1366 D1B. No question that was the point of doing this transaction, but the fact that was true is not going to be controlling or not going to somehow throw this out. Let's remember that the reason you didn't get the basis initially, even though Mr. Miller clearly was liable in the event of default on the original note, was due to a form over substance issue in the code. What the court is pointing out here, and what's very important to understand, is because it was a form over substance issue, the fact that we now have the same substance, essentially the court is saying, look, the substance is he's liable. The substance is that's still the change, that's the same. We've now corrected the form so the ordering is correct. That's reality. We don't think that you can now disregard or, in essence, make a substance over form argument at this point. The court did not agree that, in fact, the substance over form works. As the court noted the IRS's argument, it says, the IRS further contends that MMS was not petitioner, was in substance the borrower from Huntington, because Mr. Miller was required by Huntington to assign to Huntington the note he had. Because of the assignment, the IRS claimed the bank essentially owned and controlled the note that the corporation executed in favor of Mr. Miller, so was its beneficial owner. By contrast, the court notes, Mr. Miller maintains petitioner maintained on a collateral assignment. The court agreed that was an important distinction, that a collateral assignment was a different beast. The court noted the difference as followed. The security agreement clearly sets forth a collateral assignment of the security interest in the note. Moreover, a Uniform Commercial Code financing statement was filed on December 31, 1992 to perfect the bank's security interest in commercial note executed by Miller Medical Systems on or about December 30, 1992. Thus, the respondent's contention, meaning the IRS's contention, at any given point in time, Huntington held promissory notes for the identical amount due it for both Mr. Miller and MMS is simply wrong. It is inconsistent with the rights and obligations affected in the restructuring. The court goes on to note, after the restructuring, the corporation would become directly liable to the bank only in the event of default by Mr. Miller or the corporation. Absent default, the corporation was directly liable to Mr. Miller and not the bank. Consequently, Mr. Miller's collateral assignment of that note to Huntington provides no grounds for disregarding the separate indebtedness running between the corporation and Mr. Miller and between Mr. Miller and the bank. The court also dismissed the IRS's argument that the lender was looking principally to MMS as a source of funds to repay the loan, noting that while the issue had risen in some cases, that was principally where the individual and the corporation were jointly liable on the loan. That was not the case here. Only Mr. Miller was directly liable on the loan unless there was a case of default. In that case, if both of them had been liable, then the argument that obviously the bank was only considering the corporation, we had a joint liability, would change the nature. As well, I'd point out, that type of note would not seem to any longer satisfy the general requirement that we have debt from the individual to the corporation. The court also noted it did not hold against the taxpayer that he had failed to report the interest in 1993. The court essentially came to a no harm, no foul position. Now, honestly, I think that's probably a generous result because the court had decided they wanted to lean this direction anyway. Clearly, there is a risk if you fail to pick this up that a court might use this to show that the loan in reality was not the way it was written, that in fact everybody knew that it was really a loan to the corporation. But the fact that all the other actions were taken were consistent with the separate nature of the note probably had a major influence in the court viewing this as a mere foot fault. The court did point out that from a practical standpoint, since the interest income would have been offset by a deduction flowing through, that really nothing changed. It didn't really change his taxable income. It didn't change his tax. So again, the no harm, no foul contention. The court also explained the difference between this case and the case of Grogene versus Commissioner. In Grogene, which was a 1999 case, the taxpayer acquired a participation interest in a loan the bank had already made, with which the court noted was a substantially different transaction than it had in Miller. Again, things were different. That was a different structure where somebody went in and kind of acquired a note from the bank as opposed to getting an independent note and making a loan to the bank. This was not just a participation interest. Now, the IRS was next bothered by the at-risk issue under Section 465. As you may recall, Mr. Miller never actually paid on this note, and the IRS went to argue that the guarantees the RAP group had executed ensured that Mr. Miller would never actually be liable on this note, based on the guarantee waivers that were signed by the investors who guaranteed the loan. Now, the court summarized the IRS position on this one as follows: that the IRS argues that Mr. Miller was not at risk with respect to the bank indebtedness because the guarantor waivers executed by the investors resulted in him being protected against loss in the meaning of Section 465(b)(4). In the IRS's view, because the RAP group waived any right of recovery from Mr. Miller in the event they were required to perform under their guarantees, Mr. Miller faced no realistic possibility of loss with respect to the amount borrowed from Huntington and therefore may not deduct the losses attributable to. As part of his argument, the IRS maintains the petitioner was a third-party beneficiary of the contract embodied in the guarantor waivers and could therefore have defeated any action by the RAP group to recover from him the amounts they paid to the bank under their guarantees. However, the court noted that Mr. Miller himself was exposed to risk even if he, in fact, could not have been forced to reimburse his guarantors. The reality was that the bank still had the right to move against him. As the court note, even assuming that the RAP group was effectively precluded from obtaining any reimbursement from the petitioner of their guarantee payments, we do not agree this factor eliminated any realistic possibility of loss by the petitioner with regard to the Miller-Huntington loan. Under the Miller-Huntington loan, he was the primary obligor on a recourse basis. Mr. Miller gave a second mortgage on his residence to secure the obligation. It is true that when the corporation declared insolvency, which was the event of default under the note between the bank and Mr. Miller, the bank in fact sought and obtained recovery from the Rapp Group guarantors, presumably because at that time petitioner's net worth, disregarding the Miller-Huntington loan, was $273,000, consisting primarily of relatively illiquid assets such as the equity in his residence and automobile and items of personal property. However, had petitioner's financial circumstances been different, the bank was entitled to seek full or partial recovery from him, and the guarantees would be called upon there and would have probably done so, as the court phrased it. Basically, there was no certainty that the bank would choose to go after the guarantors rather than Mr. Miller directly. It could go after him, and while he may not be able to force the Rapp Group, he may not be able to be required by the Rapp Group to repay them. Reality was that the bank wasn't required to go get the money from the Rapp Group, and had he repaid the loan, he could not have gotten the money from the Rapp Group to reimburse himself. Therefore, the court found he was at risk. He was not totally protected from the risk of loss under 465. Therefore, he did not lose his chance to take the losses under the at-risk rules. Remember, the at-risk rules are independent. They can serve to block your loss just as well as the basis rules can. Now, finally, we get to, was there forgiveness of indebtedness income? The court did find there had been truly forgiveness of indebtedness income for Mr. Miller in 1994. Now, Mr. Miller was arguing that he was still technically liable to repay the Rapp Group. The court at this point said, sorry, we're not going along with you that far. The only evidence supporting the contention that he remained liable to the Rapp Group is his self-serving testimony to that effect. In essence, only Mr. Miller's testimony claimed he was still liable to them. The action certainly suggested that he wasn't liable. As the court note, the terms of the grantor waivers under which the Rapp Group waived any right of indemnification or reimbursement or subrogation from Huntington against Mr. Miller that would otherwise arrive by virtue of payments under their guarantee. Second, the court note, no more than 8 years between the Rapp Group's payments under their guarantee and the trial in the case, the Rapp Group did not seek reimbursement, nor did he make any payment in satisfaction of the liability to them. The court held that these were, in fact, reasons to believe that there had been a forgiveness of indebtedness back in 1994, that was the understanding, that he truly was relieved of the debt. However, the court then went on to find that Mr. Miller was insolvent at the time of the forgiveness of this indebtedness. Even though a financial statement prepared by him at the end of 1994 showed the debt on the bank loan as a contingent liability rather than an actual one, the court nevertheless agreed that in reality at that point it was his debt and he was insolvent at that time. Although that does get around the large inclusion of income on 1994, there are consequences going forward because when we have a forgiveness of indebtedness under 108, we have to reduce tax attributes going forward. And the court did find that, in fact, the tax attributes going forward had to be reduced. Now, when you look at this case and you compare this to the Ruckreigel result, you get a little bit concerned about how things worked because you take a look at this and figure Mr. Miller never had to come up with a dollar and nevertheless, he still gets to deduct his losses. In Ruckreigel's case, it appears clear that if this goes south, there are no guarantors sitting around, that what's going to really happen is those individuals will be poorer at the end of the day if, in fact, they have to make good on those guarantees on the debt or that debt ends up being paid by the partnership, that they will personally be less wealthy. But the reality is that this is a provision that is a form-driven provision. It is incredibly important to get the I's dotted and the T's crossed when we talk about debt basis in an S corporation. Note that, in fact, it would have been radically different for Mr. Miller if he had never had debt basis. Because if he had no loan basis, basis would never have been created for him because he never would have advanced the funds on the guarantee that would have allowed him to deduct the loss. Therefore, the losses would never have been deducted. And therefore, in fact, there would be a radically different tax result for Mr. Miller over the long term of the note. The combination of his ability to use the debt as basis and then use 108 to exclude the picking back up that income in his return in a later year made for a major difference on his tax liability. In that case, there is a real major difference between how it was handled if he had been a guarantor versus how it was handled because he was deemed to be the primary obligor, even though in reality he never paid on the debt. Now, as I noted, I'm going to be in Syracuse, New York on Monday and Tuesday of this coming week. So I'll be up there, and if any of you are up there, I look forward to seeing you when I'm there in town, talking on a couple of issues, one on pass-through entities, one on construction contractors. Hopefully I'll be able to get something recorded in the next week and back up so that we can have a new podcast for the following week. Don't be surprised if it might not relate to the Section 199 definition of construction for the purposes of the Section 199 deduction, since that's kind of a matter of interest, and I'm going to be dealing with that this week while in Syracuse. Again, the Tax Update podcast is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. We've now been doing this podcast for just about a year, so actually when we post the next one up, we'll be into our second year, and we look forward to giving you more discussions on tax matters as we move forward through the year. This has been Tax Update.